Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to find out how the omega-3 fatty acids are poison for tumors. Catholic University Leuven, which is in Belgium, published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Metabolism. That's just one of the really good and important new stories on health and healing. Also today, continuing with our deconstructing those parts of the COVID story that are simply illegitimate, we're going to be taking an in-depth look with a Dr. Peter McCullough. Now, mind you, this is a mainstream doctor. If you had to mention the top 10 cardiologists, nephrologists, in the United States, in the world, he would be in the top two. He received his undergraduate degrees at Baylor University, completed his medical degree, Alpha Omega Alpha graduate, University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. But more importantly, he is MD, PhD. He has over 1,000 articles with over 500 citations in the National Library of Medicine. That's more than any other living doctor in the world, medical doctor, but he's also a scientist. He also received the Simon Dack Award from the American College of Cardiology and the International Vincenza Award in Critical Care Nephrology for his scholarship and research. He's also one of the founders and current president of the Cardiorenal Society of America. So you're looking at one of the most published authors in the world, one of the most orthodox, pro-vaccine. He will be talking today about what he finds is terribly wrong. I just want to give his background now because it's worth listening to. And it's going to, once again, taking one of the best minds who has both a medical background and a scientific background to show you what's wrong. Now, here's what's interesting. A lot of people have been attacked once they no longer adhere to the official Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, World Health Organization lies. He's a fighter, and he's going to make some statements today that you've never heard before. Do you remember I said, I'll just give you three things that we have been proven correct on that are no longer a matter of debate. That the high amplification of the PCR, let's say they take a swab from your nose, and they take it up to 45 amplifications. That means they keep, just imagine just, you keep amplifying something to get it larger so you can actually see it. But above 35, it's functionally worthless. And yet almost everyone in this audience who's had a PCR test has had a false positive. So it's a junk science. It's worthless. And also, I'm one of the few people on the planet who actually did an in-depth interview. In fact, he told me. He said he is impatient. And he generally does 2 to 3 minute interviews. I sat for 2 hours with Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the PCR. And he couldn't stand Anthony Fauci. You'll hear his comments about Anthony Fauci, calling him an idiot and a person who shouldn't be the head of anything because he's a moron. You'll hear him say these things, and he did not say that casually. And he wanted Fauci to debate him, and Fauci wouldn't debate him because he said, don't use my PCR test for diagnosis. It's not meant for diagnosing. It's meant for amplification to see what's there. That's it. It can't tell you whether you're current COVID or which COVID you have. It can't do that. And when you have high amplifications, it's just junk. Now they're doing low amplifications, 28 cycles, which means that you're going to test negative. Ah, well, that's a game, and we caught them at it. The CDC said we're doing 28 amplifications. Well, 28 amplifications, everyone's going to test negative who got the vaccine. Therefore, they'll be able to show what? Ah, the vaccine works. That's the game they're playing on you. They're thinking that you're too stupid, so lacking in curiosity or scientific acumen, that you would not be able to understand the game they've just played. But everyone on television will universally say the vaccines work, and they are all lying. Just about everything. We also said when the New York Times started saying that they have cases, in the public's mind, a case, in a physician's mind, a case, a nurse, a case is an actively infective person manifesting symptoms. Nothing could be further from the truth. It was just someone who tested falsely positive on a fraudulent test. Now, guess what? Now the entire National Health Service of Great Britain has said, separate them. Cases are only for actively infective people. Ah, so now that you've ginned the entire system in order to make an artificial pandemic so you can create public policy, so you control people's lives, so you can get them ready for the Great Reset, now you separate out someone who has been exposed to a virus but is otherwise completely healthy versus someone who's sick. And for all this time, the New York Times, which should be held accountable for crimes against humanity, was lying. Those are just some of the things. So the question is, how many people have died because of COVID? Now, that's where it gets interesting, because you have to look at the official figures, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. But Harvard University studies show that it's between 1 and 2% accurate. 1 to 2%. That means it's 98 to 99% inaccurate, meaning they're not reporting all the figures. So then let's be very conservative and take it to where it would be. And that would be 6,000 plus deaths. All right? 6,000 plus deaths. Now, they track everyone. Oh, and by the way, the CDC vaccine tracking system designer, the Oracle director, Joel Kallman, died 2 months after receiving his COVID vaccine shot. I guess just a coincidence. In any case, you look at how many people have died, and based upon what you're about to hear, it's 50,000 Americans are dead. Now, everyone agrees, including my interview with the former commissioner of the FDA, that the vaccine reporting system is notoriously inaccurate, underreporting everything because it's voluntary. So let's just say that my guest is right. It's 50,000 dead, and then millions injured. So let's put that in proper perspective, because no one in the news is telling you any of these figures. No one. We will. And I'll tell you what it means. And I'm going to use other figures. And I've decided to use figures of how many Americans died in all of our wars. So I'm going to tell you today, every war, how many died, how many were injured, and then compare that to COVID. And then you see why someone should be saying, hold on a second, this is crazy. You mean we have all these people dying in wars, and we have more people dying from the COVID vaccine? Yeah. That's correct. That just doesn't make any sense. Well, will that get someone's attention? Probably not, because they're not looking to correct their inaccuracies. We are. So that's our show today. Plus, we'll have Bill Maher's commentary, which I think is enlightening. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. And the most important thing right now is the average American is not taking enough omega-3 fatty acids, especially the fraction called DHA. But here's what you have to know. All of the scientific literature that is published in the peer-reviewed literature and online in PubMed shows that these are good fatty acids. They're essential for your health. Why? Because they're going to help you with vision, brain function. They're going to help you with regulating your inflammatory phenomena, meaning turning off inflammation in the heart and the arteries and the brain. But now, brand new information that it also can reduce the incidence of cancer. Listen to what I just said. The omega-3 fatty acids, based upon this peer review study, can reduce the incidence of cancer. Now, how it works is subject to a major discovery by a multidisciplinary team of University of Leuven researchers who have just elucidated the biochemical mechanisms that allow DHA and other related fatty acids to slow the development of tumors. This is a major advance, and it's been published in the prestigious journal Cell Metabolism. Now, what they've done is, and the head of the team was a specialist, a Dr. Frone in oncology, discovered that cells in an acidic microenvironment, what we call acidosis, within tumors, replace glucose with lipids, meaning a sugar with a fat, as an energy source in order to multiply. In collaboration with a group of professors, they demonstrated these same cells are the most aggressive and acquire the ability to leave the original tumor to create metastasis, meaning they spread around your body. Meanwhile, they found that when you improve your dietary lipid sources, here comes the omega-3 fatty acids, then something unusual happens in a tumor cell. This is where it's really interesting. They identified in these what is called acidotic tumor cells, they responded in diametrically opposite ways depending upon the fatty acid they were absorbing. Within a few weeks, the results were both impressive and surprising. Quote, we soon found that certain fatty acids stimulated tumor cells while others killed them, killed the cells. And what was killing the cancer cells? DHA literally poisons cancer cells. It creates what is known as a fatal overload on the tumors. The poison, which is DHA, your omega-3 fatty acid, acts on tumor cells via a phenomena called ferroptosis, a type of cell death linked to the peroxidation of certain fatty acids. The greater the amount of unsaturated fatty acids, there's your omega-3 fatty acids, in the cell, the greater the risk of their oxidation. Normally, this acidic compartment within tumor cells stores these fatty acids in lipid droplets, kind of bundle in which fatty acids are protected from oxidation. But in the presence of large amounts of DHA, again, DHA, the tumor cell is overwhelmed and cannot store the DHA, which oxidizes and leads to the cell death. So, use your omega-3 fatty acids, high amounts of DHA, 200, 300 milligrams, and you're fighting cancer. That also means you're helping to prevent cancer. That's really good news. From Shahid Bahishti University of Medical Sciences, the effects of barberry consumption on flow-mediated dilation and inflammatory biomarkers in patients with hypertension. In lay language, it means there was a controlled trial. They took a simple barberry, B-A-R-B-E-R-R-Y, and they found that this allowed a greater opening of the arteries to allow more blood to flow through with less pressure, hence dropping down high blood pressure, helping if you have hypertension. So, the takeaway message is, polyphenol-rich foods, such as barberry, can reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. How about that for something really basic, really simple? Now, also helping your blood pressure, from the University of Vermont, an international team of researchers uncovered unappreciated metal role in lowering blood pressure. What was that metal? Zinc. Yes, zinc was able to help regulate blood pressure. Now, I take zinc every day. I suggest you do too, for many different reasons. The immune system, but also because it's antiviral. And for those of you who've heard my reports on ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, both are taken with zinc. It is zinc that kills the viruses. The other two mechanisms help open up the pathway to allow that synergistic effect of co-cooperation to work. Well, high blood pressure or hypertension is the leading modifiable risk factor for cardiovascular disease and premature death worldwide. And key to treating patients with conditions ranging from chest pain to stroke is understanding the intricacies of how the cells around arteries and other blood vessels work to control blood pressure. And while the importance of metals like potassium and calcium in this process are known, brand new, we didn't know this underappreciated role of zinc. It offers ways of helping with hypertension, and this was published in Nature Communications. Very important. Also, from Weill Cornell Medical Center, a study showed that the more high fructose corn syrup you consume, the greater your risk of intestinal tumor growth. That's correct. A brand new study found that, well, your average soft drink, high fructose corn syrup, a lot of your cake mix ingredients and the syrups, so many things have high fructose. It's a common sweetener. It promotes the growth of intestinal tumors. It also leads to obesity and metabolic syndrome. So this is a brand new study. So I just want people to realize when you're taking those soft drinks, that high fructose corn syrup, you're also contributing to fatty liver disease. And you're also increasing your risk of obesity, colorectal cancer. And they looked at all the plausible mechanisms believed to be behind this association, including insulin resistance and chronic inflammation and alterations in the level of growth factors and hormones secreted by fat cells, the steroid hormones. However, the influence of all these was not the same as what happens when you take high fructose corn syrup. So just do yourself a favor, stay off the high fructose. Also, for those of you who exercise, good for you. Get out there every day, do an hour of exercise. Why? Because one new study from Florida State University shows that your memory biomarkers are improved with aerobic exercise. It's going to help you with your cognition. Someone sent the president an exercise schedule. Whoa. Memory problems. And it happens to a lot of people. But exercise can help that. Don't stay sedentary. Move. And finally, from Northwest University, it is a chemical within ginseng. It's called the ginsenoside, RH4. It's a bioactive component obtained from Panax, P-A-N-A-X, ginseng. It's excellent in its functional properties, has a lot of good chemicals. What it does, it alleviates antibiotic-induced intestinal inflammation by regulating what are called TLR4, MYD88, MAPK pathways, and improving your gut microbiota. In lay language, it helps to allow that if you've been taking antibiotics to rebalance the medium, the bacteria in your intestine. Because remember, antibiotics really are miracles when you need them. And one of the greatest discoveries of all time was Alexander Fleming's antibiotics, penicillin. But if you take them too often for the wrong reasons, then you destroy the good bacteria, create a very toxic biome in the intestine. And the reason I give you the more scientific details is because we have a lot of professionals in science, medicine, who listen to the program. And I just want to let them know that, you know, where to get this. Oh, and by the way, from Osaka City University in Japan, a major study, the Mediterranean diet is linked to rheumatoid arthritis benefits. So if you've got rheumatoid arthritis, once again, those monounsaturated fatty acids could help suppress disease activity in rheumatoid arthritis patients. And this was published in the journal Clinical Nutrition. I'm Gary Nall, and we are the number one radio source, information source in the world on health and nutrition, and have been for 55 years. And going strong every day. Brand new information. We're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, we're going to go to this clip that I mentioned. We're going to do one clip a day. And so that you can see some of the best minds in the world who are there on the front lines, who are seeing the patients. Anthony Fauci and these other dancing clowns and Bill Gates, they don't see patients. He's not qualified to open a comic book. And yet, they're the ones guiding all the other medical doctors and scientists in the world. Whoa, is that really absurd? Here's the person who's fighting back. He's on your side. He's against the New York Times, MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, and all the other people supporting the establishment without any criticism of the establishment. Thank goodness you have a fighter on your side.
What is your take on this entire situation? We know that a lot of doctors have sort of changed their mind over time because they began to understand that there's a lot of evidence that points in the direction that there really is no actual pandemic, but there is something else going on. What do you think of what's going on?
Well, my quick analysis is I believe that we're under the application of a form of bioterrorism that's worldwide that appears to have been many years in the planning. And the first wave of the bioterrorism is a respiratory virus that spread across the world and affected relatively few people, about 1% of many populations, but generated great fear. The virus was responsible for some deaths in the very frail and elderly, but in otherwise well people, it was like having the common cold. But that fear was used very quickly, and I think surprisingly, to generate tremendous influences in human life, at lockdowns, all the things you know about. Mm-hmm. And every single thing that was done in the public health response to the pandemic made it worse. So over-testing and even lockdowns probably made it worse because the virus evolved over time to become more contagious. And so every single response made it worse. How I got involved is, as a doctor, I thought the virus was going to be pretty easy to treat once we understood there were three phases: the viral replication, cytokine storm, and thrombosis. And so as I promulgated early treatment, I started to meet resistance at all levels in terms of actually treating patients and then publishing papers. And so I'm the editor of two major journals. I'm in the business of publishing. So fortunately, I had enough publication strength to publish basically the only two papers in the entire medical literature that teaches doctors how to treat COVID-19 at home to prevent hospitalization and death. And we did the best we could without any funding or government support. And we demonstrated that it results in about an 85% reduction in hospitalization and death. So what we had discovered is that the suppression of early treatment was tightly linked to the development of a vaccine. And the entire program, as this, in a sense, bioterrorism phase one was rolled out, was really all about keeping the population in fear and in isolation and preparing them to accept the vaccine, which appears to be phase two of a bioterrorism operation. Both the respiratory virus and the vaccine deliver to the human body the spike protein, the gain-of-function target of this bioterrorism research. Now, I can't come out and say all that on national TV today or any time, but what we had learned over time is that we could no longer communicate with government agencies. We actually couldn't even communicate with our propagandized colleagues and major medical centers, all of which appear to be under a spell. They almost as if they're hypnotized right now. And doctors, good doctors, are doing unthinkable things like injecting biologically active messenger RNA that produces this pathogenic spike protein into pregnant women. I think when the doctors wake up from their trance, they're going to be shocked to think what they've done to people. And so our strategy was to organize. There are many groups. One group in the United States called C19 that I organized. Many of you get these emails. It's about 1,000 people. Another one's called FLCCC, Frontline Critical Care Consortium. Another worldwide one is called PANDA. You may be involved in that. There's also HEART and BIRD and COVID Medical Network, Treatment Domiciliary in Italy. It's gotten to the point where people have rallied in the UK and in Germany to rally for early treatment. Governments have actually tried to block even any single milligram of treatment to individuals. And so we decided by the summer we had to take our message to the people. We had one physician association that worked with us called the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. We created a home patient guide. We organized the United States into four national telemedicine services, 15 regional services. We broke through to the people, and the people who got sick with COVID-19 called in, got medications prescribed to local pharmacies or to mail order distribution pharmacies. And so without the government really even understanding what was going on, we crushed the epidemic curve in the United States towards the end of December and January. We basically took care of the pandemic with about 500 doctors and telemedicine services. And to this day, we treat about 25% of the U.S. COVID-19 population that actually are at high risk over age 50 with medical problems or present with severe symptoms. And we've basically handled the pandemic. And at the same time, we've tried to keep ourselves above the political fray. And we understand the suppression of early treatment is tightly linked to vaccination. And then we've let all the news on vaccination come out and are working to change the public view of the vaccine. The public initially accepted the vaccine, and we had to kind of slowly turn the ship. And now in the United States, rates of vaccination have been dropping since April 8th. They continue to drop every day. The vaccine centers that I go by are completely empty. And in the United States, they're becoming desperate to try to convince individuals to get a vaccine. They're offering $1 million lotteries. All the universities who are trying to force vaccination are receiving resistance. I'm the lead expert in the bellwether Houston Methodist case, which is currently being argued before a judge in Texas. It's going to be quickly escalated to the Supreme Court of Texas, where Houston Methodist Hospital, a leading hospital, is attempting to force the employees to receive the vaccine. And we already have word that it's going to be escalated to the Supreme Court case. It'll be a very high visibility case. So we have a lot of activity going on in the United States. We are engaging more and more attorneys. It's great to have you and your team involved, on the international level. And I imagine we're aligned on almost all the things I said.
Yes. Let me quickly translate, give us a chance, because I don't want to be rude, but I completely forgot to introduce you because I thought that everybody knows you. I think most people do. But please tell us a little about your background.
So let me introduce myself. I'm Peter McCullough. I'm a professor of medicine at Texas A&M College of Medicine on the Baylor-Dallas campus. I practice internal medicine and cardiology. When the pandemic hit, I refocused all of my efforts on COVID-19. I'm the editor of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. I'm the editor of Cardiorenal Medicine. This is my area of research. Senior associate editor of American Journal of Cardiology. I'm the president of the Cardiorenal Society. And in my field about heart and kidney connections, I'm the most published person in my field in the world in history. And I have developed great experience in treating COVID-19. I've published the two major treatment papers, and I've led the early treatment initiative in the United States. So I have, whether people like it or not, I have declared my medical authority in doing this to a greater extent than anybody in public health agencies or any other media doctors.
Thank you so much. We can sure as hell be glad that you're on our side. Extremely grateful. So it appears that in the United States, at least, things are really changing right now.
We've clearly had an impact. I'm in Texas, where we never underwent lockdown. I was a strong proponent of us staying open. We had 35 treating doctors who are willing to go against their medical centers and treat patients. We were able to convince our governor to put an executive order recognizing natural immunity, banning any mandatory vaccines by public agencies, banning vaccine passports, banning any discrimination on passports. We recently passed similar legislation for private employers. However, we were unable to get in a ban on private employers mandating the vaccine, so that part is going to be litigated with the Houston Methodist bellwether case. We're very active. We have the American Frontline Doctors as another group that has a temporary restraining order in against pediatric vaccination filed in Alabama. And we have cases filed in the state of Maine against falsely coding the test results positive on inflating the number of cases and deaths. We have a variety of activities. We have allies in Washington, Senator Ron Johnson and Senator Rand Paul. We have allies in the media, largely Fox News and Real News and OAN. We don't yet have CNN or MSNBC. But the C-19 group that I loosely formed, we now are on national TV almost every night in the United States to provide a counter viewpoint to Anthony Fauci and Walensky at the CDC and NIH. And we bring on different experts and continue to appear to the American people that we have more scientific credibility than the agencies.
And why do you think that is, that this, this window of opportunity has opened for you to be on national TV? I mean, that's quite something. I mean, here, this is.
Okay, this is an hour-long interview. It's on PRN.fm. And remember, every time I play a video, you can go to PRN.fm and scroll down the page and you'll see Gary Nall radio notes. And that there you can watch it. There are several things later. He talks about the 50,000 dead, and people are now starting to extrapolate from what is officially the dead statistic. Now, no one knows exact numbers. That's not possible, but that's the best estimate based upon being very, very liberal and saying 10% when it's actually closer to 1% or 2%. So it's even worse. And he is everywhere, and no one can challenge him on his clinical experience. He's in there. He's got two board certifications, and he's a scientist. I mean, go up against him. See how smart he is. I mean, he's treating patients, thousands of patients. And what's his protocols? Let me hear the protocol. Here it is. I'll give you part of the protocol. Ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, even prophylactically with ivermectin, and then quercetin, vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, and then if needed, an antibiotic. Where have we heard that before? How about a year and 2 months ago here? And we've produced all the hundreds of studies. We've published the list of all the studies, how many scientists were on each study, how many patients were in a study, what kind of study it was, where it was published in peer-reviewed literature, and on over 20 different mainstream FDA-approved drugs. And yet, all these have not one of these has been accepted by the New York Times, because they're captured by the pharmaceutical industry, or Anthony Fauci, or the World Health Organization. So he's on the right side, and he's just one of thousands of doctors and tens of thousands of scientists. We have over 100,000 professionals on our side now, over 100,000, and millions, and tens of millions of people. Now tonight, you talk about a top person, the top in America. For the whole hour, my guest tonight will be Professor Limon McHenry. Who's he? Never heard of him? Well, he's a bioethicist. He's emeritus professor of philosophy at California State University. He specializes in medical ethics, in the philosophy of metaphysics. He's taught at the University of Edinburgh. He is a top-ranked academic, published a lot of medical journals, engaged in a lot of scientific studies. So what am I going to ask him? And as you know, if you listen to my program, I ask hard questions. I'm going to talk about why virtually all of COVID and everything else that we're learning about cancer and arthritis in psychiatry is based upon an illusion that there's evidence-based medicine supporting it. There is not. There's a crisis of credibility in all of clinical research in America today. There's legitimate science, but it's almost always independent science. Corporate science, almost always corrupt. So I'm going to take on the entire pharmaceutical industry, all governmental agencies. I'm going to scrutinize all of them with facts, not opinion, And since he is the top ethicist in the country, let him defend them or not. It'll be an interesting hour tonight, 7 o'clock. Pass it on, something you won't want to miss. Now, I'm going to give you some facts, and then I'm going to open it up for some feedback where you'll have an opportunity to do a talk back here. Well, before we go there, why don't we just take a little break and hear what Bill Maher has to say on the woke culture.
And finally, new rule. From now on, when Joe Biden veers off into one of his long-winded stories that seem to be off topic, everyone must realize he usually does have a point.
But those of you who are over 50, how often did you ever see advertisements on television with black and white couples? Not a joke. I challenge you, find today, when you turn on the stations, sit on one station for 2 hours, and I don't know how many commercials you'll see, lay 8 to 5. 2 to 3 out of 5 have mixed race couples in it.
I'm going to tell you, I know it sounds kind of out of left field, but actually Uncle Joe is pointing liberals towards something they need to be more aware of. They have a bad case of progressive phobia. That's the phrase coined by Steven Pinker to describe a brain disorder that strikes liberals and makes them incapable of recognizing progress. It's like situational blindness, only what you can't see is that your dorm in 2021 is better than the South before the Civil War. If you think America is more racist now than ever, more sexist than before women could vote, and more homophobic, then you have progressophobia and should adjust your mask because it's covering your eyes. You know, before 2012, every time gay marriage was put before a state's voters, it lost. 35 times in a row. Now it's the law of the land in every state. Even half of Republicans are for it. The other half are for closeted gay sex. The chant from gay protesters used to be, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it." Well, we did. This is Pride Month, and it's not even a big deal anymore. 30 days of parades and festivals celebrating a cause that was once so divisive, Ellen had to pretend to be straight. State houses fly pride flags now. Disney celebrates it. By federal law, every single TV show must include a storyline about lesbians having a baby. If someone announces they're gay on TV, it's met with thunderous applause. My accountant says, "Yas, queen." You literally can't find a major American corporation that doesn't do something for Pride Month. NASCAR does it. Raytheon, maker of high-tech lethal weaponry that kills people from the sky, does it. And I hear next year they're going to paint "You Go Girl" on the side of their missile. And it's not just LGBT issues. Not that long ago, I knew people who went to prison for growing pot. And today you can legally smoke it for fun in 43% of the country, and I will. Even something like bullying, it still happens. But being outwardly cruel to people who are different is no longer acceptable. That's progress. And acknowledging progress isn't saying we're done or we don't need more. And being gloomier doesn't make you a better person. In 1958, only 4% of Americans approved of interracial marriage. Now, Gallup doesn't even bother asking. The last time they did, in 2013, 87% approve. An overwhelming majority of Americans now say they want to live in a multiracial neighborhood. That is a sea change from when I was a kid. In a country that's 14% black, 18% of the incoming class of Harvard is black. And since 2017, white students are not even a majority in our public colleges. Employees of color make up 47% of Microsoft, 50% of Target, 55% of The Gap, as companies become desperate to look like their TV commercials. The Friends reunion we just had looked weird. Because if you even suggested a show today about six people, all of whom were straight and white, the network would laugh you out of the room and then cancel you on Twitter. And yet there is a recurrent theme on the far left that things have never been worse. Kevin Hart expressed a view many hold when he told the New York Times, "You're witnessing white power and white privilege at an all-time high." This is one of the big problems with wokeness, that what you say doesn't have to make sense or jibe with the facts or ever be challenged, lest the challenge itself be conflated with racism. But saying white power and privilege is at an all-time high is just ridiculous. Higher than a century ago, the year of the Tulsa race massacre? Higher than the years when the KKK rode unchecked and Jim Crow went unchallenged? Higher than the 1960s when the Supremes and Willie Mays still couldn't stay in the same hotel as the white people they were working with? Higher than during slavery? And I mean actual slavery, not Prince doesn't like his record contract slavery. Racism is still, unfortunately, still with us. We have the footage. In policing, housing, job discrimination, segregated schools, wealth inequality, the legacy of injustice sadly lives on and demands remedial action. I understand, as best I can, how racism singes a person's soul so much that they might see it everywhere. But seeing clearly is necessary for actually fixing problems, and clearly, racism is simply no longer everywhere. It's not in my home, and it probably isn't in yours, if I read my audience right, and I think I do. For most of the country, the most unhip thing you could ever be today is a racist. Even Derek Chauvin was not backed up by his fellow officers, and that never used to happen. The low point of race relations wasn't Kim Kardashian wearing cornrows, even though it happened on Snapchat and George Wallace standing in a doorway didn't. Because here's the thing, kids. There actually was a world before you got here.
I agree with that because think of all the books that have been canceled. Catcher in the Rye. Do you think any of the woke culture could even understand the intellectual underpinnings of that book? No. And the Iliad. When was the last time any of these people ever read a classic? But they don't want us to read. They want to ban things that have been the foundation of the movements that have helped all of us be more literate and liberated. And unfortunately, if we do not speak up, then they will carry the day. And an entire generation will be functionally illiterate about everything that's really meaningful and important in life. When they say that you can't call your mother mother or dad dad, you can't do that because it offends them at some level. I don't give a damn what offends them. They're offensive at everything, and we have to push back. Pushing back against Anthony Fauci, pushing it back against the entire Washington establishment, that's everybody, by the way. Everybody, from Gloria Newman to Hillary and Bill Clinton to the Obamas, everybody in that cesspool. Washington, D.C., and everyone in it, all the military industrial contractors, all the lobbyists, all of the shysters, the CIA, the National Security Agency, it's just the most septic environment imaginable. It's like trying to find some clean drinking water in an overflowing dirty toilet. That's Washington. Anything else is just a pretense to legitimacy. So when you say that 6,000 official dead, but 50,000 more likely dead, when you say 300,000 injured, many of those permanently, then it's more like 3 million injured, then what is the consequence? Nothing, except to those who are injured. Let's put this in perspective. The Revolutionary War, there were 6,800 deaths. There were 6,100 wounded. By the way, there were 20,000 soldiers taken prisoner, 12,000 died in prison, and there was 8,000 to 12,000 died of diseases, starvation. But 6,800 dead. The War of 1812, 15,000 total American deaths, and only 2,260 military deaths, the rest were civilians. The Mexican War, 1,730 deaths in the battlefields, but 11,500 died of disease. In the Civil War, both sides, 620,000 deaths and over 475,000 wounded. The Spanish-American War, 385 deaths. And World War I, now we get to something really significant because it's more current, 53,400 deaths. That means that right now, the COVID vaccines are nearing and will surely surpass all of American deaths from combat in World War I. There were other deaths from other causes. There were 204,000 wounded. They mainly recovered. But how many of the millions who have side effects, and many of those hospitalized, many of them permanent, will not recover? World War II, 291,600 deaths in combat, 113,000 from diseases. And now you've got the Korean War, 36,600 deaths from combat. That means that right now, Anthony Fauci, the World Health Organization, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, the FDA and the CDC and the White House are responsible for more Americans dying from a vaccine than a Korean War deaths. In Vietnam, 47,400 combat deaths, 10,800 deaths from other causes. But that means that already, by any legitimate statistic, they've killed more Americans than died in the Vietnam War from combat. And yet not a word. Is there no irony in any of this? I'd like your thoughts. 888-874-4888. Why is it we cannot be honest in the mainstream media about a single one of the things I've mentioned, that you called cases instead of in positive or negative infection? You pumped up the mortality death certificates and called everything COVID death when it wasn't, including all of our influenza deaths, as if they were COVID deaths. They weren't. You also lied about the efficacy of 95% for the vaccine. You then promoted it. If you took the vaccine, you wouldn't get COVID. It was never tested. It was never studied. And yet you didn't anticipate any of the side effects, minor little inconveniences, maybe dizzy. Now you're looking at deaths and disability, and this is just the beginning, because most of the injuries and deaths will occur over the next 24 months, which is the case with other vaccines. So you've already created a deadly legacy, and yet no one is held accountable, and nobody can be sued. No vaccine maker can be sued. And now they want to take you into the great economic reset. I'd like your thoughts. 888-874-4888. If you'd like to share your opinion, we'd like to hear it. And while you're thinking about what to do, I'd like to share one more inspirational input, and that is how to change your attitude and hence change your life.
It's about your actions. All life is an experiment. The more experiments you make, the better. There is perhaps no task we can set before ourselves that offers greater rewards than striving for mastery of the world within. For no matter what has happened to us thus far, nor what may befall us in the future, greater inner harmony can only improve our well-being. This task is also unique in that it requires no additional resources to begin, no help from others, and it can be worked towards at any place and at any time. As we saw in our previous video, all that is required is a willingness to experiment and a knowledge of some of the tools we have at our disposal. In this video, and several to follow, we will explore a variety of these tools, and we will look at how to integrate them into life experiments that can help us unlock a more flourishing state of mind. The first tool we are going to examine is cognitive reframing. Cognitive reframing is a method for self-induced thought change. It can be used for many purposes, such as minimizing the impact of intrusive thoughts, correcting the faulty beliefs that give rise to irrational fears, or even escaping the downward pull of depressive ruminations. When implemented successfully, cognitive reframing shifts us away from thought patterns that make us suffer to those more conducive to a good life. In this video, we are going to explore how we can use cognitive reframing to restructure our attitude. For our attitude is very often what keeps us locked in a stagnant life of suffering, and our attitude is one element of the world within that can be modified to a remarkable degree. If we are to have any hope of achieving this type of transformation, we need to accept that our current attitude is not a singularly accurate product of our life thus far. It is easy to overlook this fact and to believe that a poor attitude on our part is justified by what we have had to endure. A difficult upbringing, mistreatment by others, or plain bad luck can easily convince us that our attitude, while perhaps not ideal, is based on the reality of our situation. This belief, however, overlooks two important considerations. Firstly, humans are susceptible to all sorts of biases, prone to self-deception, and capable of the greatest delusions. But even if we were to grant that much of what sculpted our attitude is based in fact, and not on our distorted view of these facts, this brings up the following set of questions. Which facts? Why those facts? And why not others? For as William James put it, the world is a blooming, buzzing confusion, and for order to emerge, whether it be the order of a scientific theory, or the order that creates our sense of self and our attitude toward life, we must be selective about which facts we focus on, which ones we diminish, and which ones we completely ignore. Or as Arthur Koestler explains, without the hard little bits of marble which are called facts or data, one cannot compose a mosaic. What matters, however, are not so much of the individual bits, but the successive patterns into which you arrange them, then break them up and rearrange them. Our past may be the source material from which the foundation of our attitude was built, but this material can be sculpted in many ways, and cognitive reframing can help us achieve this feat. For to reframe is simply to create new patterns of self-order by changing the way we perceive the facts of our life and by changing the way we string these facts together. To reframe means to change the conceptual and/or emotional setting or viewpoint in relation to which a situation is experienced, and to place it in another frame which fits the facts of the same concrete situation equally well or even better, and thereby changes its entire meaning. The mechanism involved here is not immediately obvious, especially if we bear in mind that there is change, while the situation itself may remain quite unchanged and, indeed, even unchangeable. What turns out to be changed as a result of reframing is the meaning attributed to the situation, and therefore its consequences, but not its concrete facts. We are now going to look at how we can integrate cognitive reframing into a life experiment that can help us cultivate a more empowered attitude. The first step in this experiment is to begin with the end in mind. We should ask.
Okay, we're going to come back to that in just a moment. I just want to say goodbye to our WBA audience. We'll look forward to seeing you back here tomorrow. We have to go to your news break at the top of the hour. But for everyone else, we're continuing on. This is from the Academy of Ideas, and there's about 4 more minutes to go, and then I'm going to take questions. We have Mayette on the line. We're going to go to her. If you'd like to call in and make statements about the issues that we're addressing, please feel free to do so. 888-874-4888. Now back to our commentary.
We should write out our answers, as this exercise and the ones to follow will be more effective if we put pen to paper. With our end in mind, we then need to ask if there is anything about ourselves or this world that absolutely precludes this possibility. If no insurmountable barriers exist, then we have formed what the psychologist William James called a living option. With our living option in mind, the next step is to make use of an exercise called mental contrasting. This entails writing out how we see our life unfolding if we remain as we are now, in contrast to how our life will become if we move toward the ideal of our living option. This exercise will not only increase our awareness of the necessity of change and the good that will befall us if we do change, but it will also create a heightened emotional state, which can make the next step of this experiment more effective. For as Michael Mahoney writes in Human Change Processes, it is in the crucibles of personally meaningful, intense emotions that patterns of experiencing may be most powerfully rescaffolded. Or as Arnold Bennett put it, there can be no knowledge without emotion. We may be aware of the truth, yet until we have felt its force, it is not ours. to the cognition of the brain must be added the experience of the soul. With the experience of our soul supporting us, we will be psychologically primed to reinterpret our past in a way that justifies a more empowered attitude. One exercise that can help us in this regard is to write out a brief life narrative, which frames the events of our past in such a way that at the end of the narrative, we are firmly planted on the path of our living option. This exercise, in other words, uses our desired future to reshape our conception of the past in the recognition that what an individual seeks to become determines what he remembers of his has been. In this sense, the future determines the past. An example can clarify the process of reframing. Perhaps we are an individual who has spent years drifting through life, accomplishing little to be proud of and trapped in an attitude of apathy and despondency. To escape from this state of mind, we do not need to deny our past, but we do need to look at it from a different angle. Instead of seeing our years as wasted, we can focus on what experiencing life in this form has taught us. We have learned the danger of drifting, the necessity of a more active approach, and the ease with which the years can pass us by. This experience could be interpreted as the spark of necessity that lit the fuse of a more empowered existence, and these wasted years could be reinterpreted as setting the stage for redemption. The process of revising a life story is not one of denying facts, wrote Michael Mahoney, diminishing the reality of past suffering or, to put it graphically, blowing sunshine up the ass. It is, however, an exploration of alternative interpretations and evaluations.
We will have more commentaries. And now, stay tuned for one of the strongest, most insightful, and wise voices within all movements, Utrecht Lead.